Stockholm, Paris, Berlin, Kiev, Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam,
Warsaw,
Bucharest,
Hello, I'm Richard Walker. Welcome to Network Europe. In the run-up to International Women's Day, we've a special programme dedicated to the women pulling the political strings in Europe. Does the current clutch of female leaders mean that women have achieved political equality? And how much are they influencing the course of European politics? We home in on France's would-be Madame la Présidente, Ségolène Royal.
It's true that politics is much more difficult for women, and yet I really think the time has come for France to have a female president. I don't think that any man with my experience would see their skills and their legitimacy questioned all the time.
Who's the world's most powerful woman? Germany's allegedly charisma-challenged Chancellor, Angela Merkel, could be. And Latvia's veteran president, Vaida Vitsa-Freiberger, ponders the meaning of International Women's Day.
One might ask, what is the point of having a Women's Day? Should we have a Men's Day and a Children's Day and an Old People's Day?
And from the top to nearer the bottom, Network Europe's woman in Brussels, Vanessa Mock, joins us for a look at those women lower down the political greasy pole. All of that and more coming up on Network Europe, a partnership of Europe's leading international broadcasters, coming to you today from Hilversum in Holland. Thursday's International Women's Day. Now, there seems to be more commemorative days than there are days of the year. Some, like World No Tobacco Day, are self-explanatory. Others, such as International Day of the Potato, seem less obvious. But why do women need a day? Men don't get a day, and do you hear us complaining? No, we rise above it. They're hardly a minority, so is there a good reason to focus on 50% of the population? One person well qualified to answer that question is Latvia's president, Vaida Vitsa-Freiberger. She's been in office for nearly 8 years and can take credit for shepherding Latvia into NATO and the EU against the odds. After a distinguished academic career, she entered politics as an MP and a little over a year later was elected president, the first woman to do so. I called President Vitsa-Freiberger in her cavernous, echoey office to ask her if she saw any point in there being an International Women's Day.
Today, one might ask, what is the point of having a Women's Day? Should we have a Men's Day and a Children's Day and an Old People's Day? And there's a positive side to it, that it draws attention to one part of the population, making us reflect whether our general attitudes in society are entirely democratic and fair towards, in this case, fully half of the human race, if not a little bit more than half. The point, I think, in terms of reminding everybody, including women themselves, that in the modern world, the fact of being a woman, and it is a unique position because, you see, men cannot have children, and that is something you can't get away from. Women do have this particular role that nature has conferred on them, and it does put a certain seal of fatality on them.
You mentioned democracy a moment ago, and I know you're a member of the Council of Women World Leaders promoting good governance and democracy. What difference does it make to the running of a country having a woman at its head, do you think?
It makes a difference to the inhabitants because they really see every day of their lives, they see democracy at work. It reminds men in their daily life that any kind of prejudice that they may harbour in the depth of their hearts against women really is inappropriate. And it, I think, reminds also women and young girls that the world they're living in or growing up in should be open and fair. And this is why, to come back to my earlier arguments, I think the 8th of March, if I see any point in it, is to remind the world about the free access of women to all positions, particularly those of responsibility, particularly those of political responsibility. If we look across the world, we have not reached a level of equality in that, and even though nature has given them the privilege of bearing children, this should not be an excuse for excluding them from any other aspects of human life.
But you yourself have had a meteoric rise in your political career. Within a year of becoming a politician, you were elected president of your country. Being a woman doesn't seem to have hindered you at all.
No, and I don't think it should. I think it's the feeling of confidence that women should acquire, of not feeling that they have to make choices, painful choices, and in my view, unnecessary and unjust choices between developing their femininity or simply being women or not imitations of men hiding their femininity under burqas or whatever, as if it was something shameful to be a woman and to be possessed of a woman's body, you see. This is the point.
But there are some difficult choices, nonetheless, that all women have to make, aren't they? I mean, for example, a lot of Latvians are taking the opportunity your country's new EU membership affords them, and they're going abroad to find better paid work. This often means a father or a mother leaving the family unit. So which is more important then, prosperity or family?
We made great efforts to join the European Union in order to give our people freedom of choice. Now they do have freedom of choice, and some of these choices, to my mind, are unwise. I feel very strongly. Children are young, really, a very short period of time. To abandon them voluntarily, to me, is not a good thing.
Do you feel that being a woman you get asked about moral dilemmas more often, like the one I just asked you, than a man in your position would do?
Certainly women are more ready to think about them and face up to them, and that alone would make it, I think, an advantage for the world to have more women leaders, because women from their childhood on do have to make difficult choices at various points still in our society. It's rather painful but good training for the kind of decision-making one has to make in politics.
Well, from Latvia's most illustrious woman now, we steam across the Baltic to Sweden, where there's certainly no shortage of women in politics. A full 47% of the country's parliamentary politicians are female, almost enough to accurately reflect the population. Mark Cummins from Radio Sweden joins me from Network Europe's Stockholm studio. Mark, it's typically progressive of Sweden to have so many women representatives, so I wonder if it's a bit old hat to talk about an International Women's Day there.
Well, it's certainly been a central focus for a long time in Sweden to encourage women not only to take part in politics, but to run for office and shape policy. Today we see that there's a very experienced pool of women politicians who've worked their way through the ranks from local assemblies up into parliament and even in the cabinet, of course. And this has been happening. This is a process that's been going on for 30, 40, almost 50 years. The success on the statistical side that you mentioned there in the introduction probably should be looked at, though, with the background knowledge of Sweden's system of proportional representation, unlike the small single-member constituencies that you have in the British Westminster system that many, at least English-speaking listeners, will be familiar with, where one candidate represents one district. In Sweden, the candidates are part of a list, and as a voter, you traditionally vote for a party, not an individual. So political parties have been able to drive the agenda and put women candidates on the party electoral lists, who are then elected on the same grounds as their male counterparts, according to whatever percent of the vote the party receives. So Swedish politics has been able to rapidly reflect the changes in social attitudes in that way. And this has been an advantage for women moving into politics.
Now, there is one female politician that's been featured in the international press lately there in Sweden who stands out in more ways than one. Nyamko Sabuni, I think you say it. And she's certainly controversial, isn't she?
That's right. Probably one of the most talked about appointments of the Reinfeldt government was the choice of Nyamko Sabuni as the Minister of Integration and Gender Equality. She's 37 and a first-generation refugee to Sweden from the Congo. Her family moved here as political refugees in the early 80s. She's been known in Sweden for some time for her very blunt statements on integration and immigration issues. As part of the small centre-right Liberal Party in Sweden, she was very clear that she thought Sweden's policy of integration has failed. And this is how she put it in the autumn of last year when I talked to her on that point.
Failed? Yes, I think we've failed. And one of the most important things is that we don't have jobs. We have as much jobs today as we had 20 years ago, and we have 500,000 more people in working force. So that's a big problem. I know that there are parties trying to say, what should we do with the new Sweden, the multicultural Sweden? And that is an issue that we haven't talked about for a long time in Sweden, because each time you try, then someone comes and calls you things. I mean, racism or discrimination or something else. But I think it's important to us not only to talk about rights for the immigrants, for the new Swedes, but also obligations, as we do with everybody in society.
As an opposition politician, Sabuni proposed that schoolgirls undergo compulsory medical examinations to check for evidence of genital mutilation or female circumcision. She denounced what she calls the honour culture of some immigrant groups and proposed outlawing arranged marriages. She's been called an Islamophobe by Muslim groups in Sweden, especially over her proposed ban on the Muslim veil for girls under the age of 15.
Glitz and glamour haven't followed Germany's first woman chancellor, Angela Merkel. Many worried at the outset that Miss Merkel didn't have enough charisma for the job. Some wondered whether this unassuming former physicist could hold her own with the heavyweights on the world stage. But it turns out she's put most of those fears to rest, as Deutsche Welle's Kyle James reports from Berlin.
She's cut an impressive figure on the world stage. She went about trying to patch up the relationship with U.S. President George W. Bush. The transatlantic friendship had landed in the deep freeze under the Schröder government because of his vocal opposition to the Iraq war. She wasn't afraid to criticize Russian President Vladimir Putin, and she's given the Israel-Palestinian conflict a top position on her foreign policy agenda. Now Germany is heading the presidency of the EU and the Group of Eight Industrial Nations, giving her a bigger profile and greater influence. Her diplomatic skills won her points at home, and she's enjoyed pretty good poll numbers on the domestic front. Germans appear to like her down-home style, a marked contrast to the designer suits and cigars of her predecessor, Gerhard Schröder. So, while she may not win any medals for flashiness or make the best dress list, Angela Merkel has proven herself an effective leader so far, both at home and abroad.
We haven't finished looking at the upper echelons of feminine power in Europe. In a moment, we go to Paris for a profile of presidential candidate Ségolène Royal. But first, spare a thought for those women toiling at the bottom of Europe's political machine.
I can wash out 44 pairs of socks and have them hanging out on the line. I can start an iron 2 dozen shirts before you can count from 1 to 9. I can scoop up a great big dipper full of lard from the drippings can. Throw the skillet, go out and do my shopping, be back before it melts in the pan, 'cause I'm a woman.
Perhaps International Women's Day would be better appreciated by the female MEPs and bureaucrats trying to make a name for themselves in Brussels. But how seriously are women taken in the EU capital? I put it to Radio Netherlands Brussels correspondent Vanessa Mock that it was surely still a man's world.
I actually don't think it is a man's world, because the women at the European Parliament and at the European Commission are very active. They're very vocal. They head up lots of committees, lots of reports. They certainly have more than their fair share of speaking time during plenaries. And so they are taken very seriously, I think, no more nor less so than their male counterparts. But the problem is, I think, that only about a third of MEPs at the European Parliament are women, a much, much higher percentage in Northern countries, especially Scandinavian countries, and you've got countries like France and Spain, which really come bottom of the pile. Just about a fifth of MEPs from Spain are women. So that really is where the whole thing just kind of falls down.
What's the life like of a woman working in Brussels or Strasbourg, the MEPs and diplomats? Do you think that the way they live and work is a good example to the working woman generally in Europe, or do you think they're having to play at being men in some way?
I think certainly in terms of the kind of institutional support they get, it's quite a good example. They don't have as much of a battle on their hands in terms of, for instance, getting creche facilities, in terms of getting maternity leave. But nevertheless, I mean, there are very, very long working hours. There's a culture of long working hours. There's also a culture of travel. And just to pick out the European Parliament, that sits 1 week per month in Strasbourg. That's 7 hours down the road by train. And so it means that for mothers, or especially for single mothers, it makes it very, very difficult. What do you do with your children then for that week? So there are facilities in place, but it's not an easy world. But I think perhaps rather than listening to me talking about it, you should just get a little snapshot of women at the European Parliament describing what the situation is like.
The main problem is always, as usual, the hierarchy. More women on the bottom and less on the top. So that's but it's true for all the countries, I think.
I'm working with a lot of women, MEPs, women, and I really like it because they are more strong than men, I must say, and they keep their opinions, they don't change it, and they are very tough, which men are not.
I would say that if anything, it's the question is of working hours and the long hours culture. Any workplace which involves meetings which go on late, or when you have frequent travel to missions to Strasbourg, that is obviously very difficult for reconciling family and working life, and that is a problem.
So that was just a little snapshot of women I spoke to this morning at the cafeteria at the European Parliament here in Brussels.
That was a nice cross-section of women working in Brussels that we heard just then, Vanessa. But how are most women still perceived in Brussels? It's still women who does the bulk of the dog's body work.
Yeah, I think that is basically the whole nub of the problem, really, that there's a disproportionate amount of women who are still doing the secretarial jobs, the administrative posts, who are working in the lower ranks of what they call here directorates, which is the different departments. The European Parliament certainly wants to clamp down on that. It's launched a whole raft of schemes. So the balance still has to be redressed. But I have to say that apart from the facts and figures of the people working here, I think I do have to mention something at the risk of sounding unpolitically correct, which is the first thing that strikes you when you go into the European Parliament here in Brussels is the overwhelming number of really good-looking, very young women walking about. And I asked one of my colleagues at the European Parliament, Jori van den Broek, who's been working at the Parliament for over a decade and heads of the communications unit, exactly why there are so many good-looking women and whether this says anything about gender discrimination, for instance. And this is what she told me.
Yeah, there are a lot of young, good-looking women around. They are usually assistants to MEPs, but mind you, also some civil servants are young and good-looking. They have passed a strenuous exam before entering the civil service here in Europe. So, and my experience with assistants, even though they're good-looking, it's maybe unfortunate even that they are good-looking, because they are incredibly bright and keen. And maybe it's because there are not so many good-looking young men around that they stand out.
Exactly. So the whole problem really is not that there are too many good-looking women, but not enough good-looking men, apparently. So bring them in.
Vanessa Mock in Brussels there. Now, looks aren't everything, of course, but having them doesn't seem to have done French presidential candidate Ségolène Royal any harm. She's the socialist candidate for April's presidential elections and has become something of a media darling in the past year, with the paparazzi snapping her with her children and even on holiday in a bikini. Attention her centre-right rival Nicolas Sarkozy can only dream of. The two are neck and neck in the polls, and Miss Royale represents the first strong chance of a woman winning the French presidency. Surveys show that the French are now prepared to elect a woman president, but this doesn't mean that sexism in France is dead and buried. Miss Royale's critics, sexists and feminists among them, say she's not doing women any favours. Radio France International's Nick Champeau reports from Paris.
Who is going to look after the kids? That's the kind of sexist joke that Royale has had to put up with during the Socialist Party's internal campaign. She won a landslide victory in the end, a sign that such sexist comments no longer pay in France. But when Royale's approval ratings fell 3 weeks ago, she was confronted with a wide range of attacks that feminists put in the sexist category. Her rivals and a number of journalists suggested she was a lightweight politician who can't keep her team together. In other words, who is not fit for the job, forcing Royale to remind people on national television that the mechanisms of the presidency are no secret for her.
It's true that politics is much more difficult for women, and yet I really think the time has come for France to have a female president. I don't think that any man with my experience would see their skills and their legitimacy questioned all the time. I advised the late President François Mitterrand for 7 years, and I prepared dozens of world summits for him.
Royale went on to explain that she's been elected Member of Parliament 4 times, that she's held 3 ministerial portfolios, and that she defeated a former Prime Minister in the regional elections 3 years ago. All that while raising 4 children with her partner, Socialist Secretary General François Hollande. Her rival Nicolas Sarkozy knows that it's difficult for a male politician to attack a woman. He's had to adapt and now lets his female colleagues be hard-hitting. Member of Parliament Nathalie Kosciusko-Morizet is one of them.
We didn't have to be instructed to criticize Royale. Personally, I'm really upset to see Ségolène Royale pretend she should not be attacked because she's a woman. She's the only woman in French politics that people couldn't attack. I don't know why. There are not enough women in French politics, but she won't solve it. There are very, very few women in her team. She does as if electing her, choosing her, would be enough for all the women of France. One woman is not the solution.
Yasmine Mohamedi firmly disagrees. She joined the Socialist Party less than a year ago. Yasmine says that the gender pay gap is huge in France and that the country is far behind when it comes to equal representation.
We have in this country, we are paralyzed by stereotypes, and people don't even realize that sometimes. And it takes a strong individual, someone with strong willpower, like Ségolène Royal, to make things change, to impose herself in the first position, the top position, in order to open doors for other women. As a symbol, you cannot think of any stronger one. It's the best. So, well, she's fighting for women as she's fighting for herself. It's the same thing right now.
Despite a parity law, only 12% of members of parliament are women. So it takes courage to be a woman in a world largely dominated by grey-haired men. But Royal is used to that. She was brought up strictly by a military officer who believed that a woman's role was to support her husband. In interviews, she often asked journalists, "Would you have asked the same question to a male politician?" when she is faced with a delicate or aggressive question. Royal often quotes feminists in her speeches, and she was the first serving minister to give birth. As a media-savvy politician, she was quite pleased when photographers from glossy magazines took pictures of her and of her newborn baby just days after she delivered. That's why Pierre Rousselin, a senior editor with the conservative daily paper Figaro, says Ségolène is in no position to complain.
She plays a lot on the glamour effect, on the fact that she is a woman, and she has to expect the media to not to forget that she's a woman. I mean, she can't have it both ways.
The problem is that sometimes Royal's factual mistakes receive far more column inches than Sarkozy's inaccurate statements. Perhaps it has to do with the fact that Le Figaro is owned by a senator who belongs to Sarkozy's camp, but that's another story. Royal is an innovative candidate in the sense that she has organized many American-style town hall meetings during which she asked ordinary citizens to talk about their daily problems. Sarkozy first mocked her initiative, but now he too is organizing meetings with real people. Susie Rochman is spokesperson for the National Collective for Women's Rights. She says Ségolène deserves a lot of credit because the daily problems of citizens are as important as geopolitical issues.
Elle est supposée ne pas connaître les grands sujets internationaux.
Because she's a woman, she's necessarily ignorant on international issues. That's outrageous. Oh, and I also heard people say she knows things that are of women's interests only. In fact, Ségolène has a lot of merit because she's trying to explain to people that issues such as domestic violence are genuine political issues. These are issues many French people are concerned with on a daily basis. Politicians shouldn't focus only on the United Nations Security Council and nuclear submarines. How can we claim to be the country of human rights if we don't crack down on domestic violence?
Ironically, the symbol of the French Republic is a woman. Her name is Marianne. Today, Marianne is just a face on postage stamps or sculpture in France's town halls. Candidates from across the political spectrum pledged they will give new life to Marianne, but who will do so, a man or a woman? The first round of the election is on April the 22nd. Paris, Nick Champeau, RFI.
While female politicians like Ségolène Royal enjoy support from their party and peers and still have to demand to be taken seriously, there's one female politician in Europe out on her own standing up to the male establishment. Every year on March the 1st in Romania, men give women a token of affection called a martisor. This year, Romania's female Minister of Justice is enjoying the sincere appreciation of a great many Romanian men, as Iulian Murasan from Radio Romania International witnessed.
This is University Square in Bucharest. It's drizzling, but from the loudspeakers here, singer and songwriter Adam Mila's music wryly proclaims that it's snowing mud. Indeed, this could describe very well the outpour of slander Monica Makovej has been subject to since she took office as Minister of Justice in December 2004. Her political opponents and part of the media called her anything from a drunk to a junkie. Just recently, the opposition parties tabled a simple motion against her, which was passed by the Senate. But if she's not at all popular across the political spectrum, civil society organized a rally to support her under the slogan Mrzisor for Monika Makovej. About 1,000 people gathered in University Square to express support for her and what civil society thinks she stands for, namely the reform of the judiciary and combating corruption. We must take a stand and stop being passive spectators at this show that's going on around us, says this middle-aged man who was one of the participants in the 1989 anti-communist revolution. I have the strange feeling that we're the same people who were here in University Square back in December 1989. I don't recognize any face, but I have this strange feeling. We're the same people fighting for the same cause as back in 1989.
We're supporting the function that she has in the minister and also the person.
Why?
Because others don't. She doesn't have the right people to stand up for her.
Do you think that democracy and the values that she stands for are in danger right now in Romania?
Yeah. That is
people were queuing up to sign a petition in support of the Minister of Justice. I joined the line with this young man.
Do you think that this is a crucial time, a crucial moment for democracy in Romania in general? Do you think
yes.
that we can lose something or gain something right now?
Yes, because the Communist Party, we see now like PSD or PCE, we are coming back and hitting all the foundation of democracy right now by blocking all the reforms we need.
I also talked to one of the organizers of the support rally, Monica Pepina from the Romanian Helsinki Committee.
We never ever had a minister like her, and she is very, very honest, and this is bothering so many people.
What's the danger? What could happen? There could be a reversion of the democratic process.
Yes, definitely. We are never going back the way we were under Iliescu's regime. My understanding, once we were entering in the European Union, it was that we are learning how to take steps forward, and this is definitely a big, huge one backward.
Though the simple motion against the Minister of Justice was passed by the Senate, the Prime Minister and leader of the National Liberal Party said he would keep her. Willy-nilly, one might add, considering that the motion was passed by the Senate with discreet but decisive help from the very party that should have supported Monika Makovej, that is, the National Liberal Party. From University Square in Bucharest, Julian Mureșan for Network Europe.
And that report brings us to the end of this special edition of Network Europe on Women in Politics. Network Europe is a partnership of Deutsche Welle, Radio France International, Radio Netherlands, Radio Slovakia, Radio Sweden, Radio Prague, Polish Radio External Services, Radio Romania and Radio Slovenia. Network Europe will be back next week, and if you were thinking the programme came to an abrupt end without a conclusion, well, I thought I'd let Jim O'Rourke do that for me. From me, Richard Walker, here in Hilversum. Thanks for listening. Women of the world, take over, 'cause if you don't